Namaskar and welcome to another episode of Ananda Marga Dharmacast. And as usual, I'll explain what it is. It's a podcast series bringing you discussion on spiritual topics based on the philosophy and teachings of Sri Sri Anandamurti. And I'm your host, Dada Veda, or Dada Veda Pragyananda. That's the long form. Whichever one you use is fine with me. So today I'm continuing with a series which I've been doing on meditation tips. But I've been going backwards. I started with the most advanced one, which is three tips for meditation. And then I did seven tips for meditation, which is more elementary. But now I'm going to the basic, and maybe this should have been first, but maybe not. I'll explain why, because it might scare you off. You know, that's the reason why, because if I come out at the beginning with this thing, maybe you won't want to meditate, but you should. So what is this? So basically, that I've given a lot of tips, and other people have given tips how to do meditation, how you sit, and you know what you think about, and some mental approach that you have to follow. This is all good. It's wonderful stuff. But there's one thing that's missing. That meditation, success in meditation, depends on your conduct during the day. So think about it. With meditation, let's say we look at it on a personal level, we're trying to change a big thing, you know, our personality, our outlook on the world, so many big things. So you can't do this with a little tinkering here and there. You need something. You have to have a fundamental basis if you're going to make such a change. So what is that fundamental basis? What the yogis say, what my teacher Sri Sri Anandamurti says, that without a moral base, meditation is impossible. It's impossible. So you need some kind of base of your daily life. Because another way to look at it is, when you sit down to meditate, let's say at evening time, you know, before your evening meal, something like that, you try to get peace. Really, that's one of the things, the many kinds of meditation, but basically, we meditate, we want peace. But if during the day we're doing all kinds of mischief and things which brings us out of balance with our environment around us, do you think you'll get the peace? I don't think so. So, if we want a foundation for meditation and spiritual practice, we need a good moral approach to the world. The world will frighten you off morals. But what it means is that we want to do things which will bring us in harmony with the people around us. And then the next part of that will be, we want to do things which will purify us. So what are those things? So the yogis and the mystics, they called it yama, or jama actually, and niyama, jama, Y-A-M-A. You know, actually in Sanskrit, Y, the letter Y, when it comes at the beginning of a word, has really a J sound. Even so, jama instead of yama. Yoga instead of yoga. But anyway, yoga is part of the lexicon, the English language, so we won't change it. And even yama, in many yoga circles, people call it yama. Doesn't matter what you call it. But the thing is that we have to practice certain things which will bring us in harmony with the environment, and that's yama. There are certain practices which will make us you can say, at ease with the environment, and the environment will be at ease with us. So the first part of this jhamma, sadhana, this first part of this moral base is ahimsa. Ahimsa, you might have heard about it because, you know, Mahatma Gandhi popularized this term. And the meaning of it is, and this is often confused, the real meaning, the basic meaning is non-injury. Himsa means harm. We shouldn't create harm to others by thought, word, and deed. So in our life, you know, we should not seek to hurt others, and we should live peacefully with others. We're not going to hurt others, but we came to just to do our thing. We didn't want to come to create injury. Now, this is a big subject, and was equated with complete nonviolence. That's really, the Jains follow this, and Buddhists follow it. The Jains are so extreme that they don't even till the soil, because, you know, when you, if you've ever been gardening, you put in your spade, and then, oh, so there's a worm that was cut in half. You know, that happens. You can't till the soil without killing some life. So the Jains don't till the soil, but they pay others to till it, so it doesn't work out. So if you're too extreme, you can't follow this ahimsa or non-injury, because even when you breathe, you might be a microbe that would be. So we should live our life normally and don't create any extra harm on the environment around us, on the people around us, the living beings around us. So that's a whole subject. Of course, the subject of food will come in, and I won't go into that now, but basically what yogis say, the developed yogis say, I won't take life where the consciousness is very highly developed. But anyway, we can debate on that, where that is or not, because of course all things, the plants behind me are living too. So everything is living. But in general, the idea, we should not harm others by thought, word, or deed. It's a very good thing to follow. That's why it's the first step. And if you follow this only, you'll be in really great shape. But there's more. There's more steps to do, more things that we'll do, which will help you to get that firm moral base, that firm stance where you can sit and really achieve peace in your meditation. You can go far with your spiritual practice, whatever kind of practice it might be. So the second one, which the yogis enumerated, they called it satya. Satya. This is also another word which is sometimes commonly misunderstood. And the reason for that is because there's really no English equivalent. Satya. Sat is the first part of that word, and this is really gives the clue. Sat means this, the unchangeable entity, the absolute. So satya sometimes is called truth. So it's like referring to the absolute truth in the sense that what is unchangeable? What is unchangeable? Like everything around us is going to transform according to the seasons, the time, and the place, and the person. Nothing remains stationary. But according to the mystics, that supreme entity, the cosmic consciousness, is immutable and unchangeable, only indestructible. So we should become one with that supreme entity. That's really what the goal of mysticism is all about. So the way to do that, one of the ways to do that is through a practice which is called benevolent truthfulness. So this is, it has to do with truth, but the benevolent, I'll explain why. And another aspect of this whole satya, which unfortunately has no English equivalent, it's based on welfare. The idea of welfare is wedded to this satya. So we should do activity which brings about the welfare of others. We should do that. And what it means in practical terms, we should speak in the spirit of welfare. We should speak in the spirit of welfare. That's why it's, in a sense, it means don't tell a lie. You don't deceive people. you know, you should, you know, the best kind of person is the one who, whatever they're thinking, that's what they say, and that's what they do. So we have to make our actions in congruence with our internal feeling. So the internal feeling should be a good one. It should be for the welfare of others, and we should speak that, and we should do that, and that we become straight. So it's really satya really means straightness in your moral life with others, in your conduct with others around you. We want to be straightforward. So that's what it really means. Now, why we call it benevolent truthfulness? Because, you know, if you go out on the street in India, you ask someone what is satya, it means to tell the truth. Yes, it's that's part of it. So we don't want to deceive others. We want to tell the truth. But suppose somebody comes to you and they say, where is my such and such? And that such and such happens to be in your living room. And then that person is a menacing, he has a knife. You know, he's coming with chains. He's, you know, you say, oh, I don't know where he is. He's not here. He left an hour ago. It's not true, but it's benevolent. So it's benevolent truthfulness. So in our life, we should be straightforward. And if necessary, to prevent harm, we don't have to be exactly straight arrow. You know, exactly, it was, I tell exactly the story. So that's satya. But people can twist satya for their own purposes. So be careful with that. But generally tell the truth and be honest with people. Be straightforward. And this straightforwardness actually is one of the secrets of spiritual success. It builds like a kind of a internal stamina in people. So that's why it is, you know, there are many politicians, one famous politician said, I am not a crook, you know, and stuff like that. So, but if internally that person feels, yes, I am a crook, I did this, I did that, I cheated the people, then how is that person? So that's why when it comes to fight, you know, you have to fight. And if your opponent is internally divided, you know, and doesn't think, I'm really a crook, you will overcome that opponent because you have the strength, the moral strength of straightforwardness. So straightforwardness is a huge asset in life, whether it be in spiritual life, even if you're in combat, it will help you because that's the whole story of the underdog winning. With that underdog who has that moral courage, that moral strength, will overcome anything in this world. So satya, benevolent truthfulness, or welfare, think about the welfare, you're going to speak and think and do for welfare. That's it, really. That's really what encapsulates satya. Speak, think, do for the welfare of all. And this is very important, because if you do like this, that you can't go wrong. You can't go wrong. So that's why ahimsa, we start off, we're not doing harm, and then we're thinking about, we're going to do something for the welfare of this world. So there you go. You're almost there. But there are a few enumerations to this yama sadhana, the sadhana, this spiritual effort, which will get you in harmony with your environment around you. So the next one is called asteya. So asteya simply means non-stealing. And this is you should find it in all the moral codes of the world. Because we had to develop this kind of thing. If people were going to live together in a society, then people had to have some basic rules of how they're going to treat each other. And because humans were able to live together, that's why they survived. In the ancient times, the human was really the naked ape. And surrounded by megafauna, big, brutal beasts. And humans were weak, comparatively, physically. And the only way they could survive is by coming together and hunting together or living together, acting together. But you can't live together comfortably if you think that person next to you is going to take something from you and steal something. So non-stealing is essential. It was essential for the history of humans, but it's essential for us to follow, that we should refrain from stealing. Now the yogis take it a step further. They say, yeah, physically people steal all the time, but sometimes people go into a place and then they see that they have the intention of stealing, but then they go into a place and they think, oh, the guard is there, I won't do it. But mentally, already that the deed is done mentally. So we should not even do the deed mentally. So that's another kind of refinement, you can say. And then another thing which Sri Sri Anandamurti points out in his book, it's a very good book, it's a little book, maybe I'll talk about it at the end, it's called The Guide to Human Conduct. He says there's another kind of theft that people do, and it's called indirect stealing. So what's indirect stealing? It's not that you took anything from another, but you didn't give what's supposed to be given. So if you sneak on the bus, in many towns they have the system where they don't really check, but then sometimes they will check. But if you go on the bus that way without paying, you have taken indirectly, you've taken some money that was due to the public, you know, to the transportation authority. So it's an indirect theft. You cheat on the taxes, different kind of indirect theft. You should have given what was due to you. Remember when we had this, we had an internet free-for-all around the year, 2000, something like that, when everyone was downloading songs, Napster and all these places, and LimeWire. I did it, you know, at that time, but I didn't think about it. But people downloaded songs, and so that kind of thing is a theft, because the songwriter, the people should have gotten the royalties and stuff like that. So now it's all it's in order, and I listen on the services, which, you know, I pay for that or like that. That's how I do it. I don't want to do that kind of thing, especially as a musical musician myself. I don't want people just stealing the stuff. So anyway, it's an indirect stealing. So we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't do that. We should get everything in order. So one thing I've heard about this that may be true, maybe not. If you could become perfect in this non-stealing. So you see, it's difficult actually when you get down to the refinement, because everybody's cut in a corner. But if you become perfect in that non-stealing, you don't have to worry about grabbing the stuff will come to you. So I don't know if that's true or not, but main thing though is really don't think about that, but think about that I should not take what's not due for me, whether it be mentally or physically, directly or indirectly. That's how I should live with those around me. And that will be, you become a great member of the society. And that's how society has flourished since the beginning. And that's why it was included in all the codes. So non-stealing, that's the third point of this yama sadhana. And then the fourth one is a one which, it's called brahmacharya. So the knowledgeable yogis in the audience will say, oh, I heard about that. But some of that knowledge is not right. So that some of the knowledgeable people will say, that means celibacy. No, how could it be? If it could be celibacy, then how many people could practice yoga or meditation, or you had to be celibate? Only a small percentage of the human population would do that, or is capable of it, or would want to do it. So brahmacharya, the real meaning is to remain attached to Brahma. Actually, it means to think about Brahma while you're moving. You're moving and you're thinking about Brahma. And what is Brahma? Brahma is the supreme entity, what we refer to in Satya, the immutable entity. So that immutable entity, that supreme entity, it's God, basically. But we use the word God, people freak out. But it's that. Whatever you want to, however you want to think of it, it's the supreme source of everything. So the idea of brahmacharya, what it means is that you see that during the day, we have to do many activities. You're not going to sit in meditation all day, right? Maybe you can do an hour, very good. Maybe you can do 2 hours, very good. But no one does it 24 hours. So what do we do during the day? What do we do? We're engaged with physical objects, whether it be the people that you're speaking to, or the tools, the eating utensils, the screens that we have in front of us. They're physical objects. So what's happening? Whenever you engage with a physical object, there's something called psychophysical parallelism. Psychophysical parallelism. Your mind becomes parallel with the physical object. That's you absorb the wavelength of that physical object, and then it's in your mind. So psychophysical, the psychic, and we're relating to the physical. But meditation is psycho-spiritual parallelism. At least we're trying for it. We're trying to make the mind engage with something beyond the physical. That's what some people call transcendental, whatever, however you want to call it. But it's beyond the physical. We don't want to think about those. You don't want to think about those, the objects around you when you're meditating, do you? I don't think so. Unless you're meditating on a particular object, you like it so much. But generally, we want to disengage. So during meditation, we have practices, which I've explained some a little bit, about how to disengage from the environment and what to do with your mind. But the problem is, what we think about and do about all day life, in our daily life, comes back to us when we close our eyes at night for meditation. So the yogis have a solution to this dilemma. What their solution is that we have to go on living in the world. We can't, shut the world down. But while we engage with the physical objects, we should think something special. We should understand something special. That this object is really an expression of Brahma, of that supreme entity, the immutable. This Brahma is here. That's why the yogis, might have seen them go like this. We're saluting God who has come in the form of my friend, or my brother, or my sister, or my son, or my daughter. That's God. It's not just a sack of skin and bones. We are a sack of skin and bones, no doubt. There's something more. So that's what we should look into, the interior of every object. We should think of the essence of every object. So if you live your life like that, this is not easy. It's not very easy. But if you live your life like that and you're thinking all the time, your mind is engaged with that spiritual entity, even though you physically... You're eating the food, but the food, God has come in the form of this tasty dish, and it's good. So everything you do becomes like a meditation, becomes meditation in action. There was once one yogi, he wrote this book called Meditation in Action. So meditation in action for me is to practice this brahmacharya, to wherever you place your foot, you think, my foot is place on Brahma. Wherever I move myself, I'm moving into Brahma. Whoever I speak to, I'm speaking to Brahma. Whoever I sit next to, that's Brahma sitting next to me. The more you think that, then when you close your eyes at night and you do meditation, you're thinking of that supreme entity. So this is brahmacharya. So it doesn't mean to be celibate. Now, why? According to Ananda Murti, what he says in his book, A Guide to Human Conduct, he says that this interpretation of brahmacharya was deliberately put there by some monks, he doesn't specify, but I think it's like the Middle Ages, in this kind of time frame, where they wanted these religious professionals wanted to maintain a one-up on the other people because they were supposedly celibate, so that they wanted to maintain a one-upmanship on the other, say, okay, you can't do it, we're celibate, you're not. But no, brahmacharya, the real brahmacharya means to think about Brahma in all your activities, even while you're walking and talking and everything. So that's what it is, brahmacharya. It's not easy, but it's like an all-around approach. It's like 24 hours a day you're engaged with the spiritual entity. And then the fifth part of the yama sadhana or yama sadhana is called aparigraha. Aparigraha, I would say, like, it means not to take. It means not to take. But a simple way would be to telegraph my thought here is that, but an easy way to think of aparigraha is a simple living. What is that? It means not to take more than you need for the maintenance of your existence on this work. So let's say everybody needs a house, right? Sure, nobody will dispute that. You need something. That's one of the minimum necessities. But do you need 10 houses? 11? How many houses does one person need? You know, so this is the question. So there are certain things that we need, and sometimes we can go overboard. So we shouldn't go overboard. We should take only what we need. And this will vary according to the time, the place, and the person. So these days, like if you live here, like where I am in America, you need a car. You can't, in most places, and there could be some cities and where you have good public transportation, but in many of the places, a car is a necessity. So in this day and age, it's 2024, and in rural America, a car is a necessity. But in 1904, a car was a luxury. A car was a luxury then, and only because there were very few of them, and only few people could have it. But the time has changed. It changes according to the person. You know, a 10-year-old kid doesn't need a car, or even a 15, okay, even a 16 when he could get his license maybe, but it's not a necessity. It's a luxury. Maybe he needs it to go out on a date or something, but it's not. He won't die if he doesn't have the family car on the weekend. So it depends on time, place, and person. So these are the five points of yama sadhana: not to hurt others, to speak with and act in the spirit of welfare, and not to take from others, to see God in all the things around us, to treat. Really, actually, this brahmacharya, another way to put it is to treat everything as an expression of God. That's really really the social aspect of it. Treat everything as an expression of God. And then the aparigraha, then to live simply in the sense that we don't take more than we need. And this comes in very handy because I'm going to go into the next part of this. I'll do it right now. I'll string you out with a cliffhanger. But the next part of this, the base of yoga, the moral base of yoga, yama, is something called niyama. So niyama, I've seen it defined like, you know, in yoga texts, they say yama means abstinences, like things you shouldn't do. Okay, that's how they say it. That's not how I say it. And then they say niyama is things you should do, observances. I will change that a little bit. Yama, the first part, these five that I just explained, these are the parts of conduct which deal with society. It puts you in harmony with the society. And niyama are the parts of conduct which bring you in internal harmony. They help you to purify yourself Because we need both. We have to be fine with those around us, but also we have impurities. We have to somehow overcome those impurities. So what are they? So the first part of this observances, we can say, with these activities which will help you to shine internally. First one is called shaucha. Shaucha means cleanliness. It's cleanliness. Cleanliness of body and mind. That's what it means. So think about that too. Also, it's an observance. If you keep clean and spick and span and nice, then when you meditate, you'll feel good. But if you're dirty and smelly and hot and the environment is not good, you're not going to get peace. So we have the first part of it is to purify the outer part of the body, which is the mind is really just it's an extension of the mind. It's the outermost part of the mind, you can say. So purify that through cleanliness. Cleanliness is next to godliness. I was searching for that phrase. Right. So you've heard that before. Cleanliness is next to godliness, and it's one of the steps to godliness, I would say. So cleanliness. But Buddha took it further than that when he told his monks, if you see something that is degrading, then turn your eyes. If you hear something which is going to bring you down, don't do it. If you smell something which is no good, don't do it. If you taste something, don't do it. So he said to have all around restraint on the senses. What he was talking about there was to get a mental purity. So we should have a mental purity. And the way to do that is to keep our internal environment pure and clean. And in Ananda Murti's book, Guide to Human Conduct, he mentions another practice which is really, really very good, related to this internal purity. He said, suppose, and it happens all the time, that a thought comes, it's not the best thought. So suppose, here's the one, I use this example a lot. Suppose there's a birthday cake being distributed. It's a little bit small, and a few people here, and you're really ravenously hungry, and you're thinking that you should have a big piece. Maybe you're so hungry you could eat the whole cake. That's not a good thought. Everybody's here to share. So it's not a good thought. So what to do about that thought? It's there. How are we going to overcome it? So he said, to overcome it, impose the opposite thought in the mind and then carry it out. So the opposite thoughts is that, yeah, I should share this cake with everybody. And then you should be the one to cut and distribute the cake to everybody, and you take the last piece, however small it may be. You take that piece and you take that yourself. And when you have completed that action, that thought, that greedy thought, will disappear. It will disappear. It will disappear. It's gone. You've overcome it. So keep your body clean and your mind pure. This is really shaocha. It's an internal practice. The society don't mind that much, except maybe at least you don't have a bad smell because you wash yourself every day. But it's really, this practice is for you. It's for you to pure. It has a little effect on us. It has effect on society some, but all of these do actually have good effect on the society. But the main thrust of this niyama is that you're going to benefit. You're going to be purified. You're going to be a better person for it. So that's what it's shaucha, or cleanliness. Then the next one is really very interesting, and it's related to something which I spoke about before, and we'll get into that. The next one is called santosha. And santosha means contentment. Atosha means like ease, a sense of ease. It's a sense of ease. You know, like when, let's say, you're very hungry. Oh, you know, when you're very hungry, you can't think of anything. You have to satisfy the hunger, and you got to do it. So then you eat, and then you're, ah. Oh. That contentment is what we want in life. That's really the, everybody's searching for that contentment. We want to be content. So we should be content, at ease, not always on the treadmill, you know, and a rat, the, you know, in the cage, the hamster's going around in the cage. We should know, we should get off that, that treadmill that the hamsters are on, and we should just relax and be calm. So that santosha, that contentment, all around contentment, that's the secret. It's really the secret of happiness. You know, just think about it like this. Everybody wants more and more. Yeah, I have $1 million, and if I have 2 million or whatever, and we don't, most of us, we don't even have 1 million. And but if you go to the people who have 1 million or 2 million or 3 million, you say, "How's it going? Is it, are you happy?" Then they say, "Oh, you know, the stock market may go down, and there's some people out there who may steal my wealth," and this kind of unease. Somebody who comes home, he already has a good job, and he takes out the laptop, and he's working, workaholic, you know, he's working around the clock, because he's trying to get more and more and more and more and more. That person, if you ask him, stop the clock a second, you say, "Are you happy? Are you content?" "Well, I need more, otherwise then I'll be..." So he's not. So we should be at ease. We should be content with whatever we got. I wrote a song about that. It's called The Secret of It All. So we should be content. And in the animal kingdom, this is also another thing which my teacher told. He said there are two examples of this kind of contentment. Good example, a bad example. So the good example is the dog. The dog is really a simple being, a wonderful being. But one of the good things about it, easily contented, you give the food to the dog, give him some affection, wags his tail, the dog rests, and the dog is content. That's in the animal kingdom. We should follow that example. And an example which we shouldn't follow, which most of us do follow in this kind of modern-day society, is the honeybee. The honeybee continues working, and the hive can burst with honey. It's still working, and then they die. They live very short lives. It's not a great example to follow. So be content. Be content with whatever you got, and don't strive for more and more and more. And that's why this is related to, I mentioned that point, aparigraha, that you should only take what you need. Because if you take more, and you have more and more and more, and you have 10 houses, then when you come home at night, you're going to have to call up all the managers of these houses to make sure that they work. You'll never get contentment. You'll never get it. So the simple living will result in contentment, santosha. So this is really important, this contentment. Because you see, what we're doing now, we're composing a personality that is peaceful, so that when you close your eyes, half the work is already done. Half the work is done if you live your life in this kind of way. You meditate, you're already there. You don't have to do much tricks. You're already there. So we should follow that. This way of life. Then the next point in this kind of purification is called tapa in Sanskrit. So tapa, it comes from the word meaning to burn. So we're going to burn. What are we going to burn? The impurities. Burn the impurities. So how to do that? So now, in the Middle Ages, people said, "Yeah, I'm a sinner," you know. They used to flagellate themselves. "Oh, I'm a sinner, God." And they would flagellate themselves. And they would think that self-flagellation, penance, they're practicing penance. Because Ananda Murti says, yeah, practice penance to reach the goal. So what is the penance? It doesn't mean self-flagellation or creating harm. God doesn't want to see us create harm to others, even on ourselves. We shouldn't do that. So what is the way, practice penance to reach the goal? It means to take on the sufferings of others upon ourselves. It means to alleviate the calamities of others, and to think, no, that I will serve others. So the practical way of saying tapa in Sanskrit is really selfless service. Selfless service. If you do this selfless service, what happens is your own ego is being diminished a little bit. Why? Because you're not thinking of yourself. That's really the biggest obstacle in meditation. You close your eyes and then you think, I did this, I did that, I'm this, I. We're thinking of the I. We want to stop thinking for a little bit. It's not possible to do it totally. We have to have that I to exist. I live here, I exist, I'm going to eat, I'm going to do. But we don't want it all the way in our meditation. We don't want it. So the way to diminish that is the more and more that you can do things for others without expecting a monetary return, without expecting public acclaim. So that's why it is also service. But service is not business. Business is when I did something, now pay me. But service is when you unilaterally give something. So this is another key to purification of the mind and internal harmony, to be internally harmonious with ourself. So this kind of tapa service. Whenever you can do it, the best. I'll tell you one little story about this. One time I was in India and there was a big flood, and there was one of my fellow monks was there on a roadway which was elevated above a whole neighborhood which had been devastated with flood, and he was on the higher ground and he was dishing out food to people. He had a big cauldron of food, and there was a line of people. They were lined up, but you couldn't see the end of them. They're coming and coming, and he was dishing it out, you know, the food. I said to Dada, I said, how are you going to do your meditation? Because we do the monks in our Anandamarga order, we do it 4 times a day. How are you going to do your meditation, your noontime meditation? He said, look, when I get involved in this work, I just have to close my eyes a second. I have tremendous concentration. Why? Because he stopped thinking of himself. You can't think of yourself when there are thousands of people coming to see you. He stopped it. So the purification is there. It kicked in. In 1 second, it kicked in. So the more we can practice this, this tapa, this do good for others, do things for others, take the suffering of others on it, then the greater will be our elevation spiritually and our peace internally. So it's one of the secrets of spiritual success. And then we come to the fourth part. This is also a five-parter of the niyama sadhana, of the observances, you can say, but of the things which will bring your mind to a more purified state, you can say. And this is called swadhyaya. It means self-study. Self-study. It means, generally it means to read things that are a scripture, in the sense that things which are based on spiritual truth, and to understand the meaning, the inner meaning of those things. Not because so many people say, yeah, I read that book, I read that Bible, I read this thing 10 times, but they read it 10 times, but it's a kind of a rote memorization. But you have to grasp the internal thought that's being conveyed to you by a spiritual being and a moral being who has come before us and wants to impart wisdom to us. So that kind of self-study, spiritual self-study, spiritual self-study is one of the roadblocks, you know, is one of the stepping stones that we have to walk on if we want to walk on this path of spirituality, self-study. So read means reading books of enlightened good people and imbibing what they had to teach, really understanding what they had to teach, make it one with you. I also wrote a song about that, about how, make it one with you. So if you can make that teaching one with you, then you've accomplished that swadhyaya. So this is like a daily kind of thing. If we can do this daily, it's wonderful. Then the last point of this kind of the inner journey of yoga foundation, this last point is called Ishvara Pranidhana. Ishvara Pranidhana. So it means Ishvara is another way of saying God. In Sanskrit, there's so many words. You know, it's like that. They used to say that the people of the Arctic had, you know, 11 words for snow. So there's also 11 words for God or for the describe the holy. But Ishvara Pranidhana is another word. Ishvara means the entity which is controlling everything. And what that means, Pranidhana means to take shelter, to take refuge. You've heard of the Buddha said it would take refuge. To take shelter. Where? In the immutable, in the unchangeable, in the controller of the universe. And how do we take shelter there? That's what meditation is. Meditation is meditation on the divine. I want to talk about a little bit about shelter, a little bit. Is that, you know, we say, like you see me, I'm existing where? I'm here, you see a picture, Illinois. But Illinois exists in the state of in the country of USA. USA is in the Northern Hemisphere. Northern Hemisphere is where? It's in the Earth. The Earth is where? It's in the solar system. The solar system is in where? It's in the galaxy. The galaxy is in where? It's in the universe. You know, so where is the universe? It's in Brahma. So we take shelter in that final place. That's the permanent address. We have to meditate on the permanent address. Yes, some people are confused. What's my permanent address? So meditate on your permanent address. So Ishvara Pranidhana means meditation on the supreme, on the permanent address, the permanent place where you are. You're not here sitting in a chair in some state or some country. You're meditating. You're sitting in that permanent Brahma, in the Ishvara. You're with that controller of the universe. So that's Ishvara Pranidhana is a meditation. So you should do your daily meditation. So this is the foundation. So what I've talked about, yama sadhana, get harmony with the environment. Niyama sadhana, purify yourself. This is the basis of all yoga. It's the basis. And without it, Anandamurti also says, spiritual practice is an impossibility. It's impossible. So if you think about it, you go hitting people and stealing and lying and cheating, taking more than you need, and you're living a, you know, impure, unclean, immoral life. You can't go far in a spiritual direction. Maybe in a physical direction for a while you can, but not spiritually. So this was the essay, the lecture, the presentation, which I should have given in the very beginning, but I didn't want to scare people away. Because why? What will scare people away is that, oh, you have to be moral. You know, it's like Sunday school. You know, you're not Sunday school. You're not going to go to hell if you don't follow these things. No one's going to go to hell for doing any of these things wrong or not perfectly. No, but what it means is that if you want to succeed and move ahead spiritually and achieve your success in life, that these kind of principles of conduct, of internal purity, like in the niyama, and the maintaining this, a nice stance with the society around us, these kind of things will come in good stead for you, and it will help you for your whole life moving forward. So I didn't say at first I wanted to scare people. Everyone is already into meditation, so I went backwards. So I went backwards in this series. I went from some very spiritual steps of how to think about when you meditate, and then I went through some practical steps of what to do when you meditate, and now I come back to the base. So strengthen that base, do the basic things, do the advanced things, and move ahead. Everyone should move ahead and do something great. So that's all I want to say today, and I hope that this was a good kind of thing for you. I hope that you liked it. And you might want to, if you're here on YouTube, give it a thumbs up if you like it. Now, some people I've seen, I watch a lot of YouTube stuff. You might know that. But people say at the very beginning, oh, like and subscribe. Don't like and subscribe. If you like it now. You listen to it. If you like it, then like it. And if you think that you can get more out of some of the things which I do, I'm not a professional in this. I'm not perfect. I don't know. I don't really, you know, have thousands of views and stuff like that. But if you think that what I say has some merit, subscribe, and I'll be back again. I'll keep trying. I'll keep doing whatever I can to spread what I know and to help you to move on your path. So do that. And if you're listening to this Ananda Marga Dharmacast, the podcast series, if you're listening on any platform, you can subscribe there. We're on audio as well as on the video. So that's all I ask. And another thing you can do, especially on, it's easy on YouTube, is share the video with others if you think that this is something good to share. So do that. So like, subscribe, share, do whatever you can, or turn it off and go to a better one. There are many great people out there. So that's all I want to say. And I thank you, and I close with the greeting of all the yogis. It means namaskar. It means I greet the divinity within you with my mind and all the love and cordiality of my heart. And I hope to see you again. Thank you.